I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Amani Alcatapa was just 9 years old when the Twin Towers fell. She heard her first racial slur shortly after. Her feelings of alienation only increased over time, and they motivated her to start a blog that would give young Muslim women a voice and fight stereotypes about Islam. Today we meet the author behind MuslimGirl.com. Also on Veterans Day, a journey back to the Vietnam War through music. We'll speak with a journalist and veteran of the conflict who curated a list of the most influential tracks of the 60s and 70s, songs that helped the troops get through the war. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The events of September 11, 2001 touched the lives of all Americans. For one Jersey girl, the impact of that day still governs many details of everyday life, things the rest of us take for granted. What to wear and how to wear it, finding directions on her smartphone, what words not to use in everyday conversation. By the time she was in high school, Amani Alcatapa had had enough of the misconceptions about Islam, the skewed media images of Muslims, and the muting of young mainstream Muslim voices. And so from her bedroom, she launched what has turned into the number one blog for Muslim women, MuslimGirl.com. Amani has also written an autobiography, Muslim Girl, A Coming of Age. It's just out, and Amani Alcatapa joins us from New York studios of NPR this morning. Amani, what a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us is Zoya Khan. Zoya is a sophomore at the University of Kansas studying political science and international studies with a focus on Middle Eastern studies. I understand you're a big fan of Amani. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
So good to have you here, Zoya. Thanks for coming over. I want to start with what's on MuslimGirl.com right now, because in the wake of the election, the headlines there are saying a lot. Here's one. I feel like hate won. Muslim women react to Trump victory. Here's another one. I'm an African-American Muslim, and I am terrified of Trump's America. Here's a third. 10 post-election self-care tips for Muslim women. Amani, is there any anecdote for the increased fear so many Muslim women and women of color are feeling today in the wake of Trump's election?
What we saw with Trump's election is that there has been a collective stamp of approval on outward expressions of racism. It doesn't take much beyond just looking at our news feeds on Facebook and Twitter to see a flood of statuses and tweets and a lot of messages about the experiences that people of color have been having just within the past 48, 72 hours since Election Day of people experiencing straight out harassment, straight out violence. People telling them, like, all right, you're out of here. You don't belong here anymore. This is great. And for a lot of us, you know, even if we personally haven't experienced that yet, or if we haven't encountered it, just to know that, you know, we're kind of like on the chopping block right now is really taking an emotional toll and a mental toll on a lot of us. Hmm. And, you know, immediately after the results came out, I think that the day after Election Day in the U.S., it was kind of just like a collective day of mourning for a lot of people. It was kind of like a lot of us were just mentally regrouping, just like with the whiplash of that message that our country just sent to us, you know, that, yeah, we co-signed this statement that we need to build walls between us. And I think that that's something that we're really trying to push back against right now.
Now, Zoya, I'm wondering what your initial reaction to Donald Trump's victory was. I mean, do you share the concerns reflected in those headlines I just read?
I absolutely share those concerns. Initially, you know, I was in shock. I think everyone in the back of our mind knew that this was a possibility, but we never really wanted to believe it. So, you know, similarly, you know, the first day I was just in shock. I didn't know what to do. And I think that was similar for a lot of Muslim students on campus, and having conversations with people in our Muslim Student Association. They just weren't sure where to go from here. We already felt, you know, unsafe enough. And now that, you know, this has happened. Again, it's normalizing this type of violence and language.
I'm wondering what the reaction of other KU students was to Donald Trump's election in terms of how they are responding to the Muslim group at KU.
There have been two stark reactions to this election. One has been an outpour of support for the Muslim students. We've received many of emails, phone calls, messages, you know,
that's
reaching
a great
out
thing.
To us. It is. It's fantastic. And I think that's one of the beautiful things of our campus. But a stark comparison would be that we have seen a sharp increase in harassment against Muslim women and violence against Muslim women. There's been a number of reports of harassment, of girls being called out, of people throwing things at Muslim women.
Wow. Amani, your book, Muslim Girl, came out during the campaign, and I was bowled over by the observation you made in the wake of the Brexit vote and Brits realizing what they'd actually done. In noting how anti-immigration rhetoric fueled the decision there, you wrote this: I imagine it's how we Americans felt when we somberly watched the poll numbers rise in favor of Donald Trump, when we introspectively watched during the primaries as states, one by one, like dominoes, bolstered his rise. I fear the feeling I will have when the same thing happens as states flip to red in favor of Trump during election night. You went on to add, at the very least, we saw it coming. You certainly saw it coming. What did you see that made you think Donald Trump might come out on top here?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I'll be honest. I really don't think that I imagined it as a reality. You know, certainly Brexit gave me the hint that it was possible. I feel like I should have allowed that experience to open my eyes even more to how much this could happen. But for me, I think that, you know, I still held this hope that we were above this. We were bigger than this.
Hmm.
And just on election night, I was actually at Javits Center with Hillary's victory party,
right,
which ended up not being a victory party anymore. And that really is exactly how I and everyone else there felt. You know, like everyone's faces changed as the hours progressed, like throughout the night. And the atmosphere there completely changed from one of excitement and anticipation to one of dread and just everything setting in. But I do think that Trump is just a product of this culture of Islamophobia that has been festering, especially post 9/11. And that's something that I really try to make clear in the book, is that Donald Trump himself isn't the problem. You know, there are millions upon millions of Americans that support him. There are millions of Americans that voted for him. And I think that's really what we have to get at. You know, like Donald Trump is the face of that sentiment now, but really there is just such a latent racism within our country that now, I guess, is bubbling over. And you know, some people say that this might be a good opportunity because now at least the racism is identified. Now at least it's out in the open. We'll know how to combat it. But I really don't see that at all. I don't see that as a positive. You know, the whole point was that we wanted to make it socially unacceptable,
mm-hmm,
for anyone to be able to express racism or to be able to discriminate or treat people differently because of their skin color or religion or what have you. And now it really honestly feels like we just slipped back several decades in our progress.
Zoya, you know, given all this, I'm wondering, how important will MuslimGirl.com be for you now and in the coming months?
I think Muslim Girl has always been a platform for Muslim women not only to express themselves, but also to relate to other people in the wider community. So I think now more than ever, you know, being able to find this platform and read stories of women who have similar experiences is more powerful than ever.
Do you call it up every day?
I try to. I definitely
bet you do. Yeah.
Amani. Zoya, wrong answer.
Amani, you grew up a Jersey girl in a family you say wasn't exceptionally devout, but you were practicing Muslims nonetheless. It was a move back to your father's homeland of Jordan, though, that had this tremendous impact on you. What did you come away with after living there for a while?
The most shocking thing to me from that experience was seeing just the huge contrast between reality and how it was being portrayed in America, right? Reality on the ground in the Middle East, how the Middle Eastern people were. I was in Jordanian society, and it was a society that was built on Islam. So for me, it was my first exposure to the actual people, the source of where all of these headlines are like coming from. And you know, I got to speak to the people that were actually practicing it, the people that could share their stories with me in their own voices rather than what I was hearing through all the white noise on the airwaves here in, on television. But, you know, I think that really just charged me up a lot because I realized, wow, you know, we are allowing this wild misrepresentation of the Muslim people in the United States to just be the foundation of such horrible foreign policy and domestic policy impacting Muslim communities that, you know, it's just so drastically different that maybe if we were able to correct that, if we're able to shift that, if we were able to reclaim that narrative, then by extension, maybe we can change public opinion
right.
and from there change policies and change people's support from these detrimental moves that are really negatively impacting Muslim women and children the most.
And the biggest and misconception was what?
Of course, the biggest misconception has always been that Muslim women are oppressed, that they need to be liberated. That was the crux of why we went into the Middle East in the first place, right? Laura Bush gave an iconic radio address in which she said that we have to go liberate Afghan women from the Taliban and from this backwards civilization. And putting it into that those terms made it like us versus them. It made us feel like we needed to go in and rescue Muslim women. Meanwhile, Afghan women on the ground were already taking their own actions for their own liberation. And, you know, we just like went in there and we disproportionately just damaged their lives more than anyone. And we need to make sure that that does not happen again. And that's just looking at foreign policy. That's not even considering how the Patriot Act has robbed Muslim Americans, even to today, of their due process rights, of their privacy rights, of placing undue surveillance on us. And I think that we really are under threat of those detrimental policies being emboldened even further under a Trump administration.
You know, your family returned to America and you came back with your hijab, having made the decision to start wearing the headscarf, having not worn it previously in America. What made you want to after being in Jordan?
Well, this was at a time where I was lying about my religion when I was in school. You know, when I was in middle school, I was hiding the fact that I was a Muslim because I was so scared of the way that other kids would treat me. And after visiting Jordan and learning more about Islam, you know, like the true principles of it and things like that, like independent of what I was hearing on American media, I really fell in love with my background and where I came from. So I saw the headscarf as a symbol of that. I saw it as my personal avenue of reclaiming my identity, the one that Islamophobia has tried to push me away from for so long. And because it is such a visible marker, I decided that I wanted it to be my public defiance of Islamophobia, my public defiance of this misrepresentation of Muslims. And you know, it was much easier said than done. I said that very, I guess, hopefully as a teenage girl. But after returning to America wearing a headscarf, you know, it was very difficult. I lost a lot of friends. I, of course, started experiencing way more racialized discrimination than I had been experiencing previously. And I almost ripped it off of my head as soon as I came back because I was like, I don't know if I can do this. But wow. I decided to like stick with it. And sticking with it, I think, was a very pivotal decision because then because of it being such a public marker it, within my community in New Jersey, it made me like a resource to the people that already knew me from before I started wearing it. So then they started coming to me to ask their questions about Islam or what they were hearing on the news. And from there, that's really how Muslim Girl was born. It was like, wow, there's so many people with these questions. Let's create a resource for them.
Well, this one article of clothing, as you point out so well in the book, has come to define Muslim women to those in the West to the point of not seeing the individual women wearing the headscarf, as you're saying here. You use France as an example. It addresses what it sees as female oppression with its own form of female oppression. Explain that to our listeners.
Absolutely. You know, I think that for us, we get so caught up in this very Western-centric narrative of us being superior, of us having the best rights in the world and things like that. When meanwhile, you know, in France, you see that we use this excuse to oppress women of color, especially Muslim women, when it comes to the burqa ban, which made global headlines, was a viral story this year. You know, from that came photos of a Muslim woman on a beach in France and police officers walking up to her and forcing her to strip on the beach, take off articles of clothing because she was covered head to toe. So to me, that didn't look any different than, you know, like the moral police that are in Saudi Arabia or in Iran, where they force women to cover their hair with a headscarf. You know, both are flip sides to the same coin. They're both controlling the way that a woman chooses to dress or conduct herself in a public space. And both are equally oppressive to women. So it's important for us to really identify that, you know, like it isn't holier than thou. It isn't, you know, us versus them. This is a collective issue of patriarchy, of sexism, that is a global trend. And you know, for us as Muslim women, I think that we've been bonded by this experience of not only experiencing the sexism, but also the racialized undertones of it when we're navigating Western countries, and then having having sexism be attributed to our religion rather right. than, you know, this global trend of it just surfacing in every culture, in every country in the world. And that, of course, has been very, very damaging to our cause.
That's the voice of Amani Al-Khattaba. We're talking with her about her blog, MuslimGirl.com, and also her autobiography, Muslim Girl, A Coming of Age. We're also joined by Zoya Khan, a sophomore over at KU. And Zoya, what's it like for Muslim women on the KU campus? Is there a feeling of inclusion or exclusion?
KU is a fantastic little oasis in the middle of Kansas. You know, as we saw during this election, Kansas is a deeply red state. And, you know, before Tuesday night, I think Muslim students felt that, you know, this was their campus, that, you know, KU is my campus. But after the violence we've seen against Muslim women, the harassment, we've called that into question. And it makes us wonder, you know, what does it mean if, you know, I am a KU student like anyone else, but I am being put on trial for the hijab on my head. So it's been a testing time, I think, for a lot of Muslim women.
What's been your own philosophy, your own approach to wearing the hijab on campus?
So I started wearing the hijab when I was very young. And for me, it wasn't about what other people thought of me or what my parents thought of me. But it was more for myself. It was about my personal relationship with my faith. And I came into it very naive, not necessarily understanding the political, social implications of what I was doing. But as I entered high school and then college, I realized that I am innately political. Even though I am a political science major, I could just be walking down the street and the image of a Muslim woman wearing hijab is a political statement.
Yeah. Amani, I'm going to go back to the headscarf for a moment and stay with that here, because among all the serious commentary, you seem to have this ongoing struggle with finding the most flattering way to wear it. One concern was it didn't help with, I believe the term you used was chubby cheeks. Have you resolved this love-hate relationship with your own headscarves?
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, I absolutely did. But I do think that, you know, feeling, especially as a teenage girl, right? I think one of the things I really wanted to make clear through the book is that I was dealing with all of the typical crap that any American teenage girl would have to deal with. And on top of that, just like the weight of all this Islamophobia post 9/11. And, you know, that I think that was a really interesting experience to have to navigate, right? It was like my body image issues, my self-esteem, the way that I presented myself, the way that I dressed, which is obviously important for a lot of young girls these days. And I think that me not being able to find a way to style my headscarf in a way that seemed, you know, like in conjunction with American trends or what was acceptable, what was cool, really hurt my confidence and my ability to connect with people. And it's interesting how my relationship with the headscarf impacted not just the way that I felt about myself, but also just the way that I was able to connect with the people around me. But yeah, today I'm very proud of the headscarf. I think that I rock it very well. I'm sure Zoya too. You know, we are thankfully now we have a lot of awesome YouTube videos at our disposal of headscarves. It's become much more mainstream. You see all these Instagrammers wearing it. And I think that's also like a very interesting thing that makes this time around different. You know, like I think that's what's really interesting about having to look at a Trump presidency now is that We millennial Muslims, we've been through this. Like, we've been through the rounds. 9/11 was, having to navigate that was the first time anyone was in our position, especially for the first generation Muslims.
And now you have Donald Trump.
now we have Donald Trump, and now we have a sort like a resource. Now we have a place of experience to look towards, you know, especially for the younger Muslims that are now going to have to go through what we went through. As sad as it is that that is the case now, at least we've already been through the rounds. We know how it is. And there are so many innovations and so many narratives coming out of the Muslim American community right now that are going to push back against that.
You know, Zoya, you had a chance to see Imani on a panel once upon a time. What did you come away with?
Yeah, that panel was amazing for me. It was an opportunity for me to see a bunch of powerful Muslim women and understand that, you know, my experience matters and that my identity as a Muslim American woman is not different from anyone else's.
Good for
and
you.
That I have the ability to, you know, fully explore my passions and my dreams and still be part of this fabric.
You know, Imani, in a relatively short amount of time, you went from high schooler working to get this thing up, this blog up and running, to sitting next to the likes of President Bill Clinton, Gloria Steinem, and First Lady Michelle Obama. What was that like? I mean, at times you must be pinching yourself.
I mean, yeah, definitely. Yeah. even now, you know, it's still a lot of those things are still setting in. It's been quite a year. And it's interesting. For me, I see these moments as milestones of progress, right? I do think that it was a huge signifier of progress that a young person like myself could be sitting between Gloria Steinem and Shonda Rhimes on a panel, especially on a panel that's about, you know, representation and diversity. To me, that was a symbol that we just elevated Islamic feminism up to, you know, beside the woman who literally led the women's movement in recent memory here
right.
in America.
Right.
And to me, that was incredible. So I actually really look to those moments for solace when I think about what's to come and what's ahead. You know, I do think that we're on the right trajectory. And this, what I really hope is that, you know, like the Trump presidency and his election, everything like that is really just the death rattle of all this adversity and all of this racism that's coming to a head. There's a lot of inroads being made. And yeah, I mean, it doesn't hurt to get that visibility of being seated beside a former president, right?
You know, Imani, when you're at one of these events, how often are you the only Muslim woman or Muslim at all, for that matter, on the panel?
Oh my God!
All the time,
so often.
Yeah, right.
If not all the time, and I think that part of the reason is the whole tokenization factor. You know, I think that people look at Muslim women like we're a monolith. So for a lot of times, it's like if we have one Muslim woman, like that's enough. And I do think that that's what happens when you're on the front lines, like when you're the first or when you're among the first of a marginalized group to be entering these new spaces that you didn't have access to before. Obviously, your presence is going to be tokenized, even though Muslim women have so many diverse experiences and come from every walk of life. So I'm really hoping that, you know, MuslimGirl.com is also just opening a lot of doors for many more Muslim women to be entering these spaces so
yeah.
that I'm not the only veiled Muslim woman or the only Muslim woman on these panels anymore.
Zoya, let's end this conversation on something of a hopeful note, on a bright spot here. What are the bright spots? What makes you hopeful going forward? Give me something to hang a hat on here.
You know, I think there are people in our wider community that understand that this country is going in a scary direction. And they understand that we can come together during this time and grow stronger because of it. I've heard from people that I haven't heard from in years, from random people on our campus who want to come together and, you know, be allies for people for marginalized identities during this time.
What's helpful for people to say to you? What do you appreciate hearing?
I appreciate people just asking me how I am.
Good.
You know, simple questions like that, just a smile, just a wave. Little things like that, yeah. I think, really add up.
Imani, what's something hopeful for you here?
Something that has been really hopeful for me, and I'm really privileged to be living in a city like New York City, but for me, it's been nonstop for the past 2 days, you know, in public, just, you know, as rude as New Yorkers typically are, I've been getting so many smiles and so many people just, you know, I feel like they see me and we're kind of like on the same page. We exchange like this glance of friendliness of, yeah, like we got this, you know, and that's something that really touches me a lot. It's like, all right, you know, no matter who's in power, it's the people who got this. And that's really exactly where I find that refuge.
That's Amani Al-Khattaba. She's the author of Muslim Girl and the editor-in-chief of MuslimGirl.com. Amani, what a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Zoya Khan also joined us here. She's a sophomore at KU studying political science and international studies. All the best to you. And I should point out, we got an email here from Doug who said, "You all are such eloquent and intelligent persons. Thank you for your efforts in promoting understanding and tolerance." So you've got some fans out there.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Zoya.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Time for a break. We're going to switch topics. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the music of the Vietnam era. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR.
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying. Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you'll be dead before your time is due, I know. Watch my dad.
You're listening to the unofficial anthem of soldiers back in the 1960s when they were more than a little eager to get out of a place called Vietnam. The life-saving impact of music may never have been more important than it was to the troops fighting in such a malign place as Vietnam. Doug Bradley and Craig Werner chronicle the importance of music and a host of key songs in their book, We Gotta Get Out of This Place. That's the song we just listened to from The Animals. We're joined now by Doug Bradley, who's a Vietnam veteran from Madison, Wisconsin. He's worked on behalf of veteran issues since his discharge. He and his co-author, Craig Werner, teach a course at the University of Wisconsin entitled The Vietnam Era, Music, Media, and Mayhem. And Doug, so good to have you. Good morning.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here, and I'd like to extend a welcome home to all the vets that are listening today.
Oh, great. As you listen to that song, can you still see yourself in Vietnam?
Are you kidding? It's almost like I never left. That was 45 years ago today that I got out of Vietnam.
45 years ago today. Wow.
45 years ago today. And it's just there was something about how that could pull people together. And that last line we sang, we changed it to There's a Better Life in the USA, because that's where we wanted to get back to.
Why that song? Was it just that line, we got to get out of this place?
You know, it's really kind of interesting. Of course, it's literal, because in Vietnam, during our tours of duty, you had 13 months if you were a Marine, 12 months if you were Army. So you knew the day you were going to leave. And so that notion of getting out of that place, sure, there was a literal association. But boy, there's something about that song, about the beat, about the lyrics, about, it's a working class kind of song that really seemed to captivate and capture who we were and where we were and what in the heck we were dealing with.
You know, I can't help but wonder if Eric Burdon and the Animals realized the impact that song had on so many of you back in those days.
You know, it's a funny thing. I doubt if they did, and neither did Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann, who wrote the song and intended it to be for the Righteous Brothers as a follow-up to You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling. I'm convinced it would have been a hit. We've heard a demo of the song. Absolutely, absolutely great, but different. And so then it ends up overseas, and it became, for the Animals, sort of their kind of song. They were going from a rough working class kind of hard scrabble life in Newcastle, moving into London. So they were moving up and getting out of that place. And I don't think the writers or the Animals knew the power this was going to have in Vietnam. We have a wonderful story. Craig interviewed Eric Burdon.
Yes.
Later. And you know, Eric Burdon talks about some Green Berets coming up to him, and he thought they were going to get all over his case, and they thanked him. for the song because it kept them alive in Vietnam.
That's amazing. Why a book on music in Vietnam, Doug?
Boy, why not? I mean, it's amazing when you think that it took us 10 years to write it and there hasn't been one. Because I think, Steve, the whole notion of when you look back to that era, radio was our internet and it connected all of us. We all listened to the same music 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so as a generation, we were connected, identified, and joined by that music. And so when we were in Vietnam, especially guys like me are in the rear later in the war, when we know we're leaving, you know, we're turning over the ground war to the South Vietnamese and we're eventually going to go home, they, in order to keep our morale up, they gave us Creature Comforts, and what they gave us was music. Armed Forces radio, you know, all throughout the country, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, cassette decks, reel-to-reel tape decks, bands in clubs, USO shows, touring acts like James Brown and Johnny Cash. So the music was just so universal and so important to us as a generation that it's, I mean, the book almost like wrote itself.
Yeah.
And to add to that, Steve, the point here is I think that a lot of Vietnam veterans, because of that shameful legacy of the war, that they weren't welcomed home, they weren't encouraged to listen, they weren't healed, could not talk about that experience for 40 or 50 years.
Wow.
They could talk about a song. And in talking about the song, we think that a lot of the men and women we interviewed got back home.
And you found in the course of writing this book, I read, that when you interviewed these soldiers, I think you said if you began a conversation by saying, hey, tell me about your experience in Vietnam, you didn't get very far. But if you began the conversation by saying, hey, what music were you listening to when you were over in Nam? It was an entirely different experience.
Absolutely. And that wasn't the case with everybody we talked to. There's still some people that can't go there, even via music. But for a number of the folks, the fact that it helped that I was a vet, but I think even later because, you know, Craig is very connected to the veteran community here and in Colorado where he grew up. I do think that made a difference. And the fact that we were willing to listen, these weren't sort of 3-minute conversations or 5-minute conversations. They sometimes took hours. And sometimes the men and women we talked to would bring their children or their spouses into the room because they hadn't heard some of this story either.
Wow. I just want to emphasize the point here that songs that so many of us here stateside never thought twice of were intensely personal to the soldiers in Vietnam. That's one of the key points of this book. Even taking a song like The Monkees' Last Train to Clarksville, which probably doesn't strike anybody as having any significance to a Vietnam war vet, but this line from that song clearly did, "I don't know if I'm ever coming home," which sort of ends one of the stanzas there. It was a big hit over there.
Absolutely. And there is not too far from Clarksville, the real Clarksville, an Army base. And guys that were taking that last train to Clarksville to go there for advanced training, next stop was Vietnam. That had all the power in the world. And there's, you know, and I don't know if it's an urban legend because who can trust anything on the internet anymore sometimes. But the songwriters, Boyce and Hart, have said that was a Vietnam song for them.
Huh.
Now, we never got that when the Monkees did it, but trust me, guys who were in training and guys and women who were in Vietnam knew that was a Vietnam song.
If any Vietnam vets out there are listening and want to call in with their personal song from their time over in Vietnam, I'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. How did you get the idea for the book?
It was really kind of interesting. Craig teaches these fabulous courses at the University on Music. He's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominating committee, and he's the chair of Afro-American Studies, so he's deeply rooted in connections that and implications that music has, especially for African-Americans. He taught both of my kids. My kids grew up here and went to the university, and they kept telling me I had to meet this guy. And Christmas of 2004, we met at a vet center here for a Christmas party. He'd been invited because he had some Vietnam vets in his class to talk about music in Vietnam. And I was there because I'm a Vietnam vet. And we started this conversation. I thanked him for being a great teacher for my kids. And he asked me what I thought of the soundtrack for his course. He'd give me a copy of the CD that dealt with Vietnam. And I started saying, well, you got to realize that when I was there, it was this music and it was this situation. Next thing we knew, there were 6 or 7 other Vietnam vets standing around us saying, well, what about this? And what about that song? And, you know, have you thought of this? And he and I, even though we just met, we exchanged this glance like, wow, there's something going on here, and it's powerful. We met a couple months later and said, you know what, we got to write a book.
Doug Bradley is my guest. His book is We Gotta Get Out of This Place. It chronicles the music of the Vietnam War era. You know, when our producers first mentioned the possibility of having you on the show, the first song that came into my mind was Buffalo Springfield's For What It's Worth. In fact, that just was the first thing I thought would automatically be in the book. But you point out something else, that far more common were songs that were more personal for lonely soldiers over there. Let's do this. Let's listen first to Buffalo Springfield, For What It's Worth, and let's talk about the personal nature of some of these songs.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
I still love that song. But your point
it's
is
a great song.
That wasn't the song of the Vietnam era, at least for the soldiers over there. Why not?
Well, you know, it was and it wasn't. It's great, Steve, that you segue to the song by talking about the personal nature. When we teach our class at Vietnam that you mentioned in the lead-in, we have vets come in and talk to the students, and we always ask the vets to start and end their presentation with a song that was important to them in Vietnam. And one semester, we had a woman who was a WAC in Vietnam and now is a Dominican nun. Her name is Sister Sarge, Linda McClanahan. And Bill Earhart, who was a Marine that was there during the Tet Offensive, had some of the most brutal experiences you can imagine in Vietnam. And they came in weeks apart, and Linda's song was For What It's Worth, and Bill's song was For What It's Worth. Huh. But for totally different reasons. Linda grew up in Berkeley and talked about seeing a police car burning at a demonstration. And at that point, she decided she didn't want the government or the protesters telling her what Vietnam was about. She wanted to go and see for herself. Mm. And she had to get her parents at the age of 18. She was under 21 as a woman to sign the papers to let her go to Vietnam. Bill Earhart comes in a few weeks later and he says, For What It's Worth. We go, gee, that's kind of interesting. That was Linda's song. And he says he was back on leave between his tours in Vietnam, and he heard that song on the radio, and he said, I'm the man with the gun over there.
Oh, wow.
Same song,
wow.
You know, two different takeaways and different meanings. And that was the power of the music in Vietnam. You could make it your own. And as you said, oftentimes the sort of fallback position for folks was, I'm lonesome, I'm scared, I'm away from home, I miss the people I love the most.
Yeah.
And so a song like Dock at the Bay or Leaving on a Jet Plane or My Girl. But,
yeah.
You know, for as much as we put a sort of a, we had a fun with the top 20 we put in the book, there are like 200 or 2,000 songs that meant something to the men and women who were there and came back home.
Yeah. Well, again, one of those songs, these personal songs that you just mentioned, you know, soldiers are missing their friends, their family, they're missing their girlfriends. One of those big songs was from Peter, Paul, and Mary. You just mentioned it. It's Leaving on a Jet Plane.
All my bags are packed. I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. Taxi's waiting, he's blowing his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could cry. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me, hold me like you'll never let me go. I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
So you know, I'm guessing, Doug, that a lot of Vietnam vets listen to that song and get choked up pretty quickly.
Oh, boy. And, you know, some people who still can't listen to it. You know, the other interesting thing, Steve, for us was we made a presentation a few years ago at a Welcome Home celebration for Vietnam vets at Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin put together. we noticed that the wives were holding their husbands' hands and tears were streaming down their faces. And that was the first time I realized, you know, because I was the guy that got on the plane and said goodbye and went to Vietnam, that the women that stayed home and every day had to worry about us and didn't want to watch the news and didn't want to hear a knock on the door, what a year that was for them. And I think it really became manifest for me when I looked out at that audience and saw these women crying, realizing that that song was their song too.
Do you have a personal connection to that song?
I do. I do because, you know, I like Peter, Paul, and Mary. I was a John Denver fan. I thought that was one of the best songs that he ever wrote. And I was in love with a young woman. It's a relationship that didn't make it through Vietnam. But, you know, when I was saying goodbye to her, that song was playing in my head.
How many veterans did you wind up talking to for the book?
About 300.
Wow.
Like I said, some still couldn't get there or get back. But it was pretty astounding, and we felt privileged to be in those conversations with these folks that hadn't taken place for maybe 40 or 50 years, and to have maybe used that conversation and the music as a way to finally bring them back.
What else do you hear from the audiences that you speak to about your book and about the importance of music over there, Doug? What other stories have they told you?
It's really astounding that at almost every event, I was just at the Truman Presidential Library over the weekend, gave their Veterans Day speech and talked about this, and heard another story that a fellow has never talked. He was there with his sister, and he shared it with me after the presentation. And so what happens is that it becomes a safe place. There's something about the music that makes it safe for, I think, vets to begin to talk about things they haven't talked about in a long time. And that's the kind of stuff we hear. It's it is extraordinary to me to realize that it's taken this long. And again, it's one of those sad legacies about the war.
You know, interesting email here. Paul called and said he would listen to a Country Joe and the Fish song, "I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die," that had this chorus, and it's 1, 2, 3, "What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam." And it's 5, 6, 7, "Open up the pearly gates, ain't no time to wonder why, whoopee, we're all gonna die." There's a happy song for you.
You know, it's absolutely amazing, though, because Country Joe has been misunderstood. You know, since Woodstock, since he did that song. When we met Joe, we interviewed him for the book at the Bart Center in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. The first thing he said to us was, "I'm a veteran first and a hippie second." Who knew Joe McDonald had been in the service?
I didn't know that, yeah.
Ah, and we didn't either. And Joe started talking about how that song was intended as gallows humor. And you can't get more gallows humor than lines like that, or be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box. Joe said he knew soldiers would get it because, you know, when situations are horrible when you're in the military, you sometimes laugh because so you don't cry and or go crazy. And Joe, that was part of his intent for that song. He still gets hate mail to this day. People say, you know, disrespectful, unpatriotic, anti-American, and yet Joe intended that in a different way. And I think that's why that song came up again and again and again as we interviewed these men and women who got what Joe was intending and sang that song in Vietnam in order to keep themselves from crying.
You know, in the early days of the war, one favorite song was the very patriotic-sounding Sergeant Barry Sadler's Ballad of the Green Berets. Remember this one?
Trained to live off nature's land, trained in combat hand to hand, men who fight by night and day, courage take from the Green Beret.
You know, I think it's fair to conclude that when you write about this in the book, Doug, that tastes in popular music changed and changed dramatically over the course of the war. Because, as you write, as the war changed, the music changed with it. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's just listening to the song, Steve. When you think of all the incredible music in 1966 in America, the Beatles, you know, just getting to their heights. This is prior to Sgt. Pepper. The Stones were great. A lot of the British groups, Motown, country. That was the number one song of the year, Ballad of the Green Berets. Which, wow. It really astounding. But, you know, by the time that year ended, I mean, as you pointed out, the Beach Boys went from fun, fun, fun to Good Vibrations. You know, look at what happened to the Beatles. James Brown went from I Feel Good to Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. There was like seismic shifts going on in America that was amplified in the music. And the soldiers got that. You know, I was in college when I was hearing these songs and getting, you know, getting my attitude. And then here I am a soldier and the song stayed with me. But boy, they could change the meaning. And then the music changed, as you said, drastically, dramatically.
You know, one song you wanted to talk about was Chuck Berry and Johnny B. Goode. Is there a Missouri connection with that one?
Well, of course, you know, Chuck is
from St. Louis.
He's from St. Louis. And that, of course, you know, when you had these cover bands, and we had absolutely really, really great cover bands in Vietnam. I want to give a major shout out. And we interviewed a guy in the book, a guy named Edgar Acosta, who is a Filipino who sang in a group called the Six Uglies, had one of the members of his band killed in Vietnam, you know, when they were subjected to a rocket attack. But the Filipino bands, the Korean bands, the Vietnamese bands were wonderful, and they entertained us. Every time they would have an absolutely tremendous guitar player who would play Johnny B. Goode. Huh. And if that didn't take us back to our, you know, to our youth, to the spawning of rock and roll, to the beginning of us identifying ourselves as a different generation, as the rock and roll generation, There's not many songs that do it better than Johnny B. Goode.
Hey, I just got about 20 seconds left. I want to get to one other track, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. You write in the book that Marvin Gaye wrote it after listening to his brother's experiences in Vietnam. Just tell us quickly about Marvin Gaye.
Marvin Gaye listened to Frankie. He did what a lot of people didn't do. He said, if you want to talk, I'm willing to listen. That helped to get his brother home. And he made one of the all-time great songs and great albums, What's Going On, as a tribute and also as sort of an indication of what his brother Frankie and other Vietnam vets were experiencing.
Doug Bradley.
It healed him.
Doug Bradley's book, We Gotta Get Out of This Place. Hey, it's been great having you, Doug. Thanks for a great conversation.
Thank
sure
you,
appreciate
Steve.
It. Yeah.
Thank you, Steve.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some
On Monday, Dr. Wes Crenshaw will discuss the concerns of young people after the results of this week's election. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from KCUR's Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer, that's Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.
Picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.